Let's turn to Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13. Remember, we're looking at Paul's first sermon. This is the first sermon of the Apostle Paul. It's the first of three missionary sermons that Paul will give. 13, 16 to 41 is the first one that we're looking at now. We started last week and we'll complete this week, or we'll complete the sermon itself, and next week we'll look at the results of that sermon. He gives another one in 14, 14 through 17 that we'll look at just briefly tonight, and then one in 17, 22 through 31, and that's the one he gives at Athens, where he talks about the plaque to an unknown God. And the one addressed to the Jews is given first, and this is the one we're looking at. And remember that it started off with a history of Jewish history. Now, here's the first missionary journey, as we've looked at before, and we're all going to have this firmly etched in our minds by the time we get through with this book, because we're going to keep going back and looking at this map so we can kind of get it set in our minds where Paul's first missionary journey took him. Remember, he started down here at Antioch. That's in Antioch, Syrian Antioch, as it's called, down to Cyprus, across Cyprus, up here to Pamphylia, the region of Pamphylia, then straight north to Antioch, Pisidia, then over to Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe, and then back around. And this line here with the arrow indicates that John Mark left and went back to Jerusalem when they got to Pamphylia. So that's their... That's the first missionary journey of Paul. It lasted about a year and a half, starting in April of 47 and ending in September of 48. Now, I thought it'd be interesting to take this square that we look at here every week of Paul's journey and set it on a map, a current map of the area. And this black square would be approximately what we're looking at there on Paul's missionary journey. So he's starting in Syria, over to Cyprus, and up through Turkey. The city called Konya, can you see that? It's right there. That's what would have been called Iconium in Paul's day. So that would be where he went over in the Galatian territory. So the Galatian territories that we're looking at are in what would be modern-day Turkey. That's where this takes place. Now, as far as Paul's message is concerned, and remember, he gave this message at Antioch. He's moved up inland now from Pamphylia to Antioch, and he's giving his first sermon. It outlines this way. First, a historical retrospect in verse 16 through 22. Proclamation of Messiah in verse 23 through 25, and we looked at these last week. We'll just review them briefly. And the rejection of Messiah in verse 26 through 31. And again, we'll review these in a minute, but just very briefly. And then the proclamation of the gospel in verse 32 through 41. So Paul is going to point out that even though Messiah was rejected, the gospel is still offered. We started last time in verse 16 looking at his audience. And we noted that Paul's audience here was not limited to Jews only, even though he went to the synagogues. In verse 16, when Paul starts out his sermon, Paul stood up and motioning with his hand said, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen." So we have two groups in the audience, the men of Israel and the you who fear God. Now, you who fear God would be a Gentile group. They would be the Gentiles who are attracted to Judaism because it's a monotheistic religion and because it's a very moral religion, but they didn't want to go through all the hassles of becoming circumcised, keeping the law, observing all the Sabbath days and the holy days and all that. They didn't want to mess with that, so they weren't really full-fledged Jews. They were still Gentiles. Now this group, the one he calls, "and you who fear God," the Gentiles, are going to be more receptive to the gospel than the full-fledged Jews. And this is going to happen here at Antioch, as we'll see as we study on. And later, these guys are going to be intimidated by the Jews, because we'll find out the Jews are, they get very upset. And put yourself in their place. Here you are, a Jew, and Paul comes down and he speaks at your synagogue. And the Gentiles get really excited about it. And everybody leaves. Next week, you come back to church or to synagogue, and the place is just flooded with Gentiles. They're everywhere. You can't even sit in your own seat because there's a Gentile in it. You know, so they get very upset about all this, and they don't like what Paul's preaching anyway. So there's going to be a split here, and that these people will be intimidated by the Jews, and Paul will correct that in the book of Galatians. Now, this trend with the Gentiles being more receptive to the gospel than the Jews is going to mark off a major turning point now in the spread of the gospel, because Paul and Barnabas are going to start a new policy. Look down at verse 46, for example. We'll get to this next week, but we can look down just to see the trend is shifting here. Verse 46 says, Paul and Barnabas spoke out boldly and said it was necessary that the word of God be spoken to you first. And that's the Jews. Since you repudiate it and judge yourselves unworthy of eternal life, behold, we are turning to the Gentiles. So there's going to be a shift, a major shift in the spread of the gospel. And you can see that in the second and third sermons that Paul does on his missionary journeys. Look over at chapter 14 and verse 13 through 15. And when he's at Lystra, in verse 13, it says, the priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifices, offer sacrifice with the crowds, that is, to Paul and Barnabas. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out and saying, men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you, and preach the gospel to you, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God. And notice how what he appeals to here is not Jewish history anymore. He says, now, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and that is all that is in them? So he's talking about what we might call common grace. And he's going to appeal to the people there on the basis of common grace. And when he gets to Athens in chapter 17. Now, Paul is one to take his message and make it fit for the audience, but you'll see the audience is changing now. Look at chapter 17, verse 22, on the Mars Hill sermon. And now he's not going to appeal to Jewish history or common grace, either one. He's going to appeal to Greek philosophy. In verse 22 it says, so Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you see the message is changing now. The audience is changing, and Paul will be turning to the Gentiles. In verse 17 through 22, last time we looked at the first sermon, and this one was delivered in a synagogue, and it's addressed primarily to the Jews first. And he does that by giving a historical retrospect of nation Israel. And in verse 17, we see, he says, the God of this people, Israel, chose our fathers. So God chose Israel. In the last part of the verse, God delivered Israel. It says, he made the people great during their stay in the land of Egypt, and with an uplifted arm, he led them out from it. In verse 18 through 21, Paul keeps going through Jewish history, talking about God's preservation of nation Israel. Verse 18, for a period of about 40 years, he put up with them in the wilderness. When he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he distributed their land as an inheritance, all of which took about 450 years. After these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. Then they asked for a king, and God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. After he had removed him, he raised up David. Now, in verse 22, we see that God provided for Israel. And it says, to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will. Now from there, Paul skips forward from David, clear up to Jesus. And he talks about the rejection of Messiah. And he links Jesus with David. He's going to use an argument that Jesus is the fulfillment of the promises that were made to David. And Paul's going to argue that these promises couldn't have been specifically to David because they couldn't have been fulfilled in him. And we'll see that later in verse 35 and 36. So he talks about the rejection of Messiah then, starting at verse 26, when he says, brethren, sons of Abraham's family, and those among you who fear God, to us the message of this salvation has been sent. For those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him nor the utterances of the prophets which are read every Sabbath, fulfill these by condemning him. So Paul shows the irony of the situation that these Jews went down every Sunday or every Sabbath day and they read prophecies about Jesus. When Jesus showed up, they killed him. They crucified him. So it's kind of ironic. Then they go back to the synagogue next Sabbath and read some more prophecies about the one they killed. So they rejected Messiah. And he points out three things about the rejection of Messiah. First, that it brought salvation. In verse 26, he says, the message of this salvation. It revealed God's sovereignty by what we just looked at, the Jews fulfilling the prophecies, even though they had no idea they were fulfilling the prophecies. And it displayed the victory of Jesus in verse 30, where it says, but God raised him from the dead. Now, that brings us then to the proclamation of the gospel. Now, here Paul will proclaim the gospel in verse 32 through 41. Let's read that, starting at verse 32. And we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers, that God has fulfilled this promise to our children in that he raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second Psalm, you are my son, today I have begotten you. As for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no longer to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David. Therefore, he also says in another psalm, you will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay. For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers and underwent decay. But he whom God raised did not undergo decay. Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through him forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you, and through him everyone who believes is freed from all things from which you could not be freed through the law of Moses. Therefore, take heed, so that the things spoken of in the prophets may not come upon you. Behold, you scoffers, and marvel, and perish, for I am accomplishing a work in your days, a work which you will never believe, though someone should describe it to you. Okay, the first thing, let's go back to the details and look at verse 32. He says, and we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers. Now, the words we preach and good news go together. They're separated here. It says, and we preach to you the good news. Good news, or we preach good news, is the word euangelizo. Euangelizo. It's a compound word, and there are two ideas involved in the word. The first one is an activity. It's we preach. The second one, it tells about what is preached. The you on the front means good. We have that in English. We say euthanasia. That's a good death. Or euphemism. It's a good way of saying something. But the word euangelizo means to proclaim good news. Two very clear ideas. And we kind of miss that in some of the translations. Look over at Galatians 1, for example. In Galatians chapter 1, we see that same word translated. Start at verse 15. But when God, who had set me apart even from my mother's womb and called me through his grace, was pleased to reveal his Son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles. That's the word preach there is the same word we have, euangelizo, but they only show one side of it over there, don't they? It just says we preach. It doesn't say we preach good news, but that's kind of built into the word. Maybe a better translation of this would be that so that I might preach good news about him among the Gentiles. But there's two clear ideas involved in that word. In secular Greek, the word euangelizo could refer to any kind of good news. Nothing specific in that word, just good news. In fact, Moulton and Milligan, which is a book of references of words used in the Bible, but used somewhere else. They cite an example of the word being used for the announcement of a marriage. So it's proclaiming good news of a marriage. So it could, secular-wise, it could refer to any kind of good news. Now in the New Testament, the word always refers to good news from God to man. Not always the gospel, but always good news from God to man. Look at Luke chapter 1, for example. We'll look at a place where it's not used of the gospel, but it is used of good news from God to man. In verse 19, and what it's talking about here is the announcing the news of the birth of John the Baptist. And in verse 19, it says, the angel answered and said to him, I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news and to preach good news to you. The same word over there. So sometimes it's used of good news other than the gospel, but most generally, what you see the word used for, euangelizo, is proclaiming the message of salvation. And that's how it's used here in Acts 13. And that's what Paul is saying down in verse 32 when he says, and we preach to you the good news. He's talking about the message of salvation. Now in verse 33 through 37, he gives some support for the gospel. First, he proclaims it in verse 32, or says he's proclaiming it, and then he gives some support. And the gospel here is going to be supported by three Old Testament verses. Now, the good news that Paul is talking about in verse 32 is not going to be something he made up. It's going to be supported by facts, and it'll be supported by the Old Testament. First, he's going to quote Psalm 2:7, and that's going to talk about the promise that was made. Then Isaiah 55:3, it's going to be a renewal of the promise or a reiteration of the promise. And then Psalm 16:10, and Psalm 16:10 is very important. It's going to be the reason why the promise made to David could not have been fulfilled in David. And we'll see how Paul uses that argument. And we'll look back at Peter's argument, and it's going to be basically the very same thing. They're both going to argue the same thing. So before we start these verses, we ought to look at one thing, and that is the word raised up, or the words raised up in English, the single word in Greek. But verse 33 and verse 34 both talk about Jesus being raised up. Verse 33 says that God has fulfilled this promise to our children and that he raised up Jesus. Now in verse 34 it says, as for the fact that he raised him up, so and the same word is used in the Greek, and the meaning in those two verses is going to be different. When you see that word raised up, it has several different meanings, and the exact meaning has to be determined by the context. And we'll see here, it's pretty simple to understand what he's talking about, but you have to be careful because he's using that word in two different ways. Now, according to Bauer, Arndt, and Gingrich's lexicon, that word has 11 different meanings. It's the word anistemi in Greek, and it has 11 different, not completely different meanings, but different nuances of meaning, 11 different ones. So you have to look at your context to determine what it's talking about. It can mean just simply to raise somebody from a sitting to a standing position, or a laying from a standing position. Look at Acts chapter 9. And we'll see in Acts chapter 9, the word is used in two different ways as well, in two verses that are next to each other. In chapter 9, verse 41, this is after Peter had just raised Tabitha from the dead. Verse 41 says, and he gave her his hand and raised her up. So after he had raised her from the dead, he just reached down and raised her up to a standing position. It just means to bring to a standing position. But back in verse 40, it said, Tabitha, arise. And it's the same word there. So in that instance, he's talking about bringing back from the dead. So you see the word has different meanings, and you determine it by the context. Now the word can mean to cause to enter the scene, if you want to put it that way. Look at Acts chapter 7 and verse 37. And this is one of the meanings we'll have in Acts chapter 13. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 37, it says, this is the Moses who said to the sons of Israel, God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. So to raise up means to cause to appear on the scene. Acts 13:33 is using it in that way. It says in verse 33 that God has fulfilled this promise to our children in that he raised up Jesus. Not talking about the resurrection there, but talking about Jesus coming onto the scene. And in verse 34, it's very clearly talking about raised up in the sense of resurrection, because in verse 34 it says, as for the fact that he raised him up from the dead. So it's very clear there. So we have those two different meanings. We need to keep those in mind as we look at these verses. Now let's look at the first quote, and that's in verse 33, and the quote is from Psalm chapter 2. It says that God has fulfilled this promise to our children in that he raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second psalm. You are my son, today I have begotten you. Look back at Psalm 2, and we'll just look at that in its context. Psalm 2. You have to love Psalm 2, don't you? Psalm 2, you can think of as an inauguration psalm. But I love that. Reading it, verse 1, it says, "Why are the nations in an uproar, and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us." Now, what's God's response to all this? He starts chewing his fingernails, right? No. Now, verse 4 says, "He who sits in the heavens laughs." It's a joke to him. All the world, here, all the nations of the world shaking their fist at God and saying, "We're going to take care of you." And he just, yeah, right, is the idea. I just had to throw that in because I love this psalm. But in verse 7, it says, "I will surely tell you of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.'" And that's the quote that Paul uses up in Acts chapter 13. So the theme of the psalm is the inauguration of the King of Israel. He says in verse 6, "But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain." And verse 7, "I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord." So it's talking about the inauguration of the King of Israel. And it's we have to step back and say, wait a minute. It says in verse 7, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." Does that mean that there was a point in time where Jesus wasn't God's son? Actually, Jesus has been God the Son throughout eternity. But he's placed in a special relationship of sonship in Psalm 2 by the decree of God. It doesn't mean that Jesus was born. It means that Jesus was placed in a special relationship of sonship to God, even though he had been son throughout eternity. Now, on the way back to Psalm or Acts chapter 13, stop at Isaiah 55, and we'll see the second quote. And this is a reiteration of the promises made to David. Remember, Psalm 2 is the Psalm of David, and in Psalm or Isaiah 55, those promises made to David are reiterated. Psalm or Isaiah 55 talks very clearly about salvation by God's grace. Look at verse 1. It says, "Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money, without cost. Why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live." So he's talking about life here. He's talking about salvation. And he's saying, why are you spending money or trying to earn a salvation that isn't really salvation at all? He says, why do you spend your money for what is not bread? And your wages for what does not satisfy? But notice in verse 3, he tells what that salvation is based on. He says, "Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercies shown to David." So the promise is reiterated, and that's Acts chapter 13 and verse 34, the quote there, where he says in verse 34, "As the for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no longer to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, 'I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David.'" So God renewed his promise that he made to David in Isaiah 55. Now, what Paul is going to do next is he's going to prove that that promise that was made to David could not have been fulfilled apart from the resurrected Messiah. It couldn't have been just to David. You could read those Psalms and think, well, yeah, God made a promise to David, so what does that have to do with me? Well, Paul is going to prove that Psalm couldn't have been just about David, and that's verse 35. He says, therefore, he also says in another psalm, you will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay. That's Psalm 16:10. And again, a very important psalm, a very important verse in the Old Testament, because this is the argument that Paul uses, and Peter used the same argument. Look back in Acts chapter 2. They use the same argument to show that the promises made to David are being fulfilled in Jesus Christ. In verse 25, it says, for David says of him, I saw the Lord always in my presence, for he is at my right hand, so that I will not be shaken. Therefore, my heart was glad and my tongue exalted. Moreover, my flesh also will live in hope, because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. Now, that's the Psalm 16:10 again. He says that you will not abandon my soul to Hades, that is the place of the dead or the grave, you might say, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. And that's David speaking. Now the question is, did David expect to be kept from the grave forever? Did he expect to live forever and never die or undergo decay? Well, no, he didn't. Why not? Well, because the psalm is prophetic. It's not talking about David himself. It's talking about one of his descendants. Now, the psalm was written by David. When we get to Acts chapter 13, guess what? David is dead. David has long since decayed. So the psalm couldn't apply to him, could it? So that's Paul's argument in verse 35. He says, you will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay. Verse 36, for David, after he'd served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep. What did he do? He died and was laid among his fathers and underwent decay. So here the psalm says the Holy One will not undergo decay. David died and decayed. So it has to be a promise that was made concerning not David himself, but one of his descendants. Now both Peter and Paul see this the same way and use the same argument. Now notice, it's kind of interesting here that they assume that the scriptures are true, don't they? Now, what would be human viewpoint? Well, David said in Psalm 16 that he would not die and not undergo decay. David died, he underwent decay. Well, the Bible's wrong. That's human viewpoint. Now, what did Paul and Peter? They said, well, you know, David is dead, therefore, what? The psalm is prophetic. It had to be talking about one of his descendants, and that's how it turned out to be. David knew that the psalm would be fulfilled in one of his descendants. He didn't expect to live forever without decay. So that's how Paul proves that Jesus is the one who fulfills the promises, because they couldn't have been to David himself. So in verse 38 through 41 now, Paul goes on to proclaim the gospel. Now remember last week, we looked at the gospel message in verse 26 through 31, and verse 26 through 31 of Acts 13 deals primarily with the historical aspects of the gospel. Remember we talked about that? It was talking about history. Look at verse 26. It says, brethren, sons of Abraham's family, and those among you who fear God, to us the message of this salvation has been sent. For those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him nor the utterances of the prophets, which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled these by condemning him. And though they found no ground for putting him to death, they asked Pilate that he be executed. And when they had carried out all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead, and for many days he appeared to those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. So he's talking about the historical aspects of the crucifixion. Now, in verse 38 through 41, he's going to turn to the spiritual aspects of that same event, or the, you could say, the theological aspects of the gospel. First, he told what the historical events were. They put him to death. He died. He rose from the dead. Didn't say much about what that means. Now he turns to what that means. And in verse 38 through 41, Paul introduces two new lines of teaching here, and they're going to come back again and again in Paul's writing. First, salvation by faith, of course, and then a contrast between Moses and Christ. First, salvation by faith in verse 38 and 39. He says in verse 38, "Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through him forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you, and through him everyone who believes is freed from all things." In verse 39, and the reason I'm slowing down here is because the verse divisions are different in the Greek and English, and I have to look down. In verse 39, it says, "And through him everyone who believes is freed." And that word freed is the Greek word dikaiō. Dikaiō is the New Testament word for justification. It's the same word we have in Romans chapter 3. Look at Romans 3:24. Start at verse 23, the verse everyone is familiar with. It says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified," same word there, dikaiō, "as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus." So it's the word for justification. And back in Acts chapter 13, he talks about justification and the condition that is placed on justification. Verse 39, "And through him everyone who believes is freed from all things, from which you could not be justified through the law of Moses." That's the word for justification. So Paul gives the gospel message there that salvation is by faith. Now, he gives the full exposition of the gospel in the book of Romans. Remember, we looked at that in great detail. He defends that gospel of salvation by faith in the book of Galatians. So there's two accomplishments that he lists here of the historical events that took place that we read about in verse 26 through 31, the rejection of Messiah. What were the theological aspects of that? You know what I like to say in communion? Yes, Christ died, but a lot of people have died through over the centuries. What's different about Christ's death? The significant thing about his death is that it brought about forgiveness and it brought about justification. Forgiveness, the negative aspect of salvation, if you want to look at it that way, forgiveness of sins. Verse 38 says, "Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through him forgiveness of sins is proclaimed." And then justification in verse 39, "And through him everyone who believes is justified." As we noted, that word means justified. That's the positive aspect of salvation. That forgiveness wipes our slate clean. Now, that alone is not enough for salvation, because what's required for salvation? The righteousness of God. And that is provided by justification. That's the positive side. Not only are our slates wiped clean, but God places the righteousness of God on our account. And that's done on the basis of God's grace. And in verse 43, we have that down, and we'll look at that next week. It says, when the meeting of the synagogue had broken up, many of the Jews and of the God-fearing proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, were urging them to continue in the grace of God. Now we'll notice, as we go through this section, that as soon as people start believing this message of salvation by faith, Satan is going to start his attack. And remember, Antioch is in the Galatian territories. Remember in Galatians 1, where Paul says, I'm amazed at how quickly you're deserting the gospel. That's who he's talking about, these guys here in the Galatian territory. So they believed the message. As soon as they did, Satan is after them. And he was somewhat successful there. So Paul wrote the book of Galatians to refute that. Of course, the Galatians, what happened was the legalists came in and said, you guys can't really be saved unless you become Jews. And that's how Satan got in there. Now, Satan has never, ever stopped his attack on this doctrine. He still attacks it all the time. Two of his favorite methods. That one that he used in the Galatian churches was to get people to believe that the righteousness of God can be satisfied by man. That's salvation by our own goodness. Another one he likes to use is to think that the righteousness that God demands can be compromised. Well, God will grade on the curve. I'm better than that guy down the street. And I like to think of it, I know the standard illustration, but it's a very good one. If you're flying in an airplane, and when I fly in an airplane, I like to come in for the landing because you can look down and see things down there. When you're in an airplane, you look down and you see two people walking on the street, and they look like ants, don't they? If one of them is 5'4" and the other is 6'2", you know what? You can't tell from up there. That's kind of the way it is with God. You know, He's perfectly righteous. If I'm a little bit better than Joe Blow down the street, you know, to him, that's still miles away. But people try to get, well, God's going to grade on the curve. I'm better than this other person, so God will take that into account. Well, that's not how the righteousness of God works. Either it's imputed to you and you have all of it, or you may as well have none of it. And that's how Satan loves to attack that gospel of salvation by faith alone. Now in verse 40 and 41, we have a warning to those who don't believe. Verse 40 says, therefore take heed so that the things spoken of in the prophets may not come upon you. Behold, you scoffers, and marvel, and perish. For I am accomplishing a work in your days, a work which you will never believe, though someone should describe it to you. Remember, we looked at this just in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul is describing that concept of what's called judicial blindness. In other words, if you hear the gospel, if you reject the gospel, then it becomes harder for you to believe the gospel. You hear the gospel and reject the gospel again, it becomes even harder. And so on and so forth. If truth is rejected again and again, it becomes harder and harder to believe because God judges that. There's a cause and effect relationship between rejection of truth and judgment. Now we're going to see this worked out in history concerning nation Israel through the rest of the book of Acts. And that's why when we get down to verse 46, Paul is going to say at the end of the verse, behold, we are turning to the Gentiles. Why? Because they proclaimed truth to the Jews. The Jews rejected truth. God blinds the Jews. They're judicially blinded so that they can't believe the truth. So Paul turns to the Gentiles. So next time we'll look at the results then of Paul's sermon. And we'll start there and then verse 42 next week. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the inspired church history that you've given us in the book of Acts. Thank you for your gospel message and for giving it to us as Gentiles. Father, thank you for sending your Son to die on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins. It's in his name we pray. Amen.